You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
We will continue on a remorseless mission to squeeze Russia from the global economy piece by piece, day by day, and week by week.
One thing, of course, we could also do is to make an open and unconditional offer to Ukrainian refugees to house them in the United Kingdom.
We haven't seen all of what Putin's going to do at the moment. We do not know what his end goal is.
You're listening to Bloomberg Westminster, your daily guide to British politics. I'm Ewan Potts.
Good afternoon, I'm Stephen Carroll. Coming up on today's programme, we're speaking to Labour's Tan Desi, and we'll get the latest from Northern Ireland as we interview the deputy leader of the Alliance Party, Stephen Farry.
So Boris Johnson's insisting the government has limited options for tackling the surging cost of living. The Prime Minister pledged to help Britons, quote, where we can, but beyond extending the energy price cap system beyond 2023, the Queen's speech offered little in the way of new measures to ease the burden facing households.
But a hint from Johnson, who told the Commons he will be saying more about this in the days to come. Something else that's set to rumble on in the coming days and weeks is the simmering row over the Northern Ireland Protocol, that post-Brexit agreement with the European Union. Foreign Secretary Liz Truss says the British government will not shy away from taking action to stabilise the situation, potentially risking a trade war with the EU.
And house building, another hardy perennial, back in the news. Under plans outlined in the Queen's speech, neighbours will be allowed to hold referendums over house extensions, new homes and conversions on their street. And it's reported the government will raid big developers' profits to fund schools, roads and other infrastructure to encourage residents to agree to more local house building.
Well, let's discuss the day's big issues with our first guest, Labour MP for Slough, Tamajit Singh Desi. Tan is also Shadow Rail Minister. Tan, thanks very much for being with us. Let's start
Thank
off
you
then
very much
with
for having you.
The government's plans on house building. Getting local consent, a key part of this plan, to more development. Surely that's very important.
Look, we've heard this all before. Last year, within the Queen's speech, there was a planning bill that has now since been scrapped because once the Conservative backbenchers got their teeth into it, the Medici-style renaissance and a pledge to build at least 300,000 new homes a year has been significantly watered down. But on the one side, I'm glad that we're going to have more consultation with residents, and we need to make sure that local people are very much involved. So we need that democratic system and accountability. But what we cannot get away from the fact is that within the Queen's speech, the bill as is proposed will not lead to a major house building process, and that will not help to tackle the housing crisis. Not to mention the fact that within the Queen's speech, there wasn't any mention of how immediate steps of how to tackle the cost of living crisis either.
How would Labour build more houses? Do you see a need to enforce more house building on local communities? Because after all, if you leave local communities to make their own decisions on house building, generally people tend to say they don't want lots more houses in their neighbourhoods. So there must be perhaps some sort of element of pushing houses on communities.
Well, look, we need to take communities on board, but we need to ensure that there are targets for every single council area, and that those measures are implemented whereby the building does take place, especially on brownfield sites. There are certain areas where the social housing, there's been a paltry amount. So we can't tackle that housing crisis. And I've got many people coming up to me in Flower within my constituency surgeries. They can't get onto the council housing register simply because there is a lack of supply. So we need to ensure that the supply is there for social housing as well as affordable housing. And we can't always be torpedoed by land banking as it happens with various developers as well. So, you know, the government gives the soundbites, but then it doesn't actually act against those developers that are hoarding large amounts of land.
Now, the Brexit Freedoms Bill, which allows EU rules to be more easily removed, is a key piece of legislation featuring in the Queen's speech. Do you welcome the government's plans to make the best of Brexit?
Well, what an absolute shambles. I remember when I stood up on the floor of the House, this was back in 2019, and I challenged the Prime Minister then that what you are proposing will inevitably lead to a customs and regulatory border down the IRC. We were told no, nothing of the sort. And then the government actually signed up to the Northern Ireland Protocol, and lo and behold, what has happened now? They are looking to tear up the very thing that they agreed, signed up to. Boris Johnson himself made great play of it at the time. And now it's left communities in Northern Ireland, especially the DUP, who feel that they have been sold down the river. So it's just another aspect of the incompetence of this government, that you cannot sign up to deals and then be looking to tear them up. What this will do, by the way, is in the middle of a cost of living crisis, in the midst of the highest inflation since 1992, the highest tax burden since the 1960s, not to mention the biggest drop in living standards since the 1960s, we will then be involved in a trade war with our European Union neighbours. That will only hurt businesses and consumers more, and that's why I think that it is an absolute shambles.
But this is what the DUP wants in Northern Ireland. They want changes to be made to the protocol. They want the British government to act on this. They're setting it as a precondition of restoring power-sharing government in Northern Ireland. Is there any other way around this? Is the government not obliged to take these steps to try and keep that peace process together in Northern Ireland and get an up-and-running government there?
Well, I agree with you that we needed a government that respected the Good Friday Agreement, that would have ensured that there isn't a customs and regulatory border down the IRC. So we are where we are because of the agreement that was agreed on and signed upon by Boris Johnson. I know now that they will have to do a U-turn on that, but if they do not do that in the correct manner, then it will inevitably lead to a trade war. So they've now got themselves into a real pickle, and they need to ensure that they undertake things in the right way rather than this diplomacy by Twitter or by the likes of Liz Truss thinking that they are going to be going in and pretending to be the Iron Lady or something. She needs to, with the government, be sitting down with our European Union neighbours and working out a sensible solution which would actually respect the Good Friday Agreement.
Now, Tan, something else in the Queen's speech: plans to simplify the rail network and improve services for passengers. The government is planning to create the Great British Railways. Now, undoing the spaghetti of the 90s privatisation is something that neither party's really got to grips with. So this is long overdue, isn't it?
But we've also heard about this talk about modernising railways, this Great British Railways headquarters and so on. But what was lacking was that we needed a mass rolling program of electrification in order to tackle the climate crisis and to ensure that we don't fall further behind our European neighbours. What has happened is in the last decade, when we've had more awareness around the climate crisis, we needed that rolling program, an annual program of electrification of our railways. Because what's happened, unfortunately, Ewan and Stephen, is that we've got to a situation whereby only 38% of our railways is electrified. That compares with our European neighbours who have managed to electrify the majority of their railways. The Germans, for example, are at 61%, the Italians are at 76%, the Belgians are even at 86% of their railways that have been electrified. So we've been calling on this for years, and I know that in the last 2 years, as the Shadow Rail Minister, that's what I've been requesting. What we needed was an outlining from the government as to how they would not renege on their promises, whether it's to the north, that they would not betray those communities. They would build the Northern Powerhouse Rail in full, as well as the HS2 and the Western Rail Link to Heathrow in full. Unfortunately, no such commitment has been forthcoming. Instead, this general talk of modernisation, this general talk around a great British railway. And unfortunately, during the pandemic, this would have been the perfect time to take rail back into public ownership. Instead, what ended up happening was the government paid out billions of pounds, and within that was included well over £200 million towards the profits of those franchises. So in essence, they privatised the profits and nationalised the risk. That's what needed. You know, we needed to get rid of that, and that now we needed a bold plan to go forward to set targets, especially annual targets, to get more freight onto our rail as well.
Just to be clear, Labour is sticking by its pledge to renationalise the railways. That's not being dropped like some of your other renationalisation commitments.
No, I think Keir Starmer, Angela Rayner, and the Labour front bench, including my good colleague, the Shadow Transport Secretary Lou Hague, we have been clear that that's what should have been done during the pandemic, and that's the best way. We need to put people before profit, and we need to ensure that, there is not just a guiding mind, but an integrated way. There is a major role for private firms in the delivery of goods and services, so that needs to happen, but we also need to have devolution. Actually, so a London-style oyster system, which is what Metromir is, especially when I've had conversations with the likes of Andy Burnham and Steve Rotherham in Manchester and Liverpool, for example, they want to be in charge of their own metro transport systems, a public transport system which is integrated, which whereby somebody can get onto a train or a tram, link that in, integrate that in with the bus network, and we should give them the freedom to do that as well.
Do you love Elon Musk? Do you hate Elon Musk? Do you have no idea what to think about Elon Musk? Then we have just the show for you.
He's become even more larger than life.
Buying Twitter doesn't get us closer to Mars.
They are like really close to the edge of like everything falling apart.
Like, oh, Elon, I volunteer, put a chip in my brain.
Each week on this podcast, we'll break down, analyze, and debate the most important stories on Musk and his empire.
It's all one big universe. You just work for Elon Inc.
From Bloomberg Businessweek, this is Elon Inc. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
We're going to turn now to look at the situation in Northern Ireland. We're joined by Stephen Farry, Deputy Leader of the Alliance Party and MP for North Down. Stephen, thank you for being with us.
No problem. Hello.
The UK's Foreign Secretary, in a statement, is again escalating the UK government's threats over the Northern Ireland Protocol, saying the British government won't shy away from taking action if solutions can't be found. It's not the first time we've heard this sort of language from the British government. What's your reaction when you hear things like that?
Well, yes, indeed. We've heard a lot of rhetoric, and clearly it is escalating. And to be clear, from our perspective, if any of this becomes reality over the coming days and weeks, it would be a grossly irresponsible act on the part of the UK government. It would do enormous damage to Northern Ireland itself, but also it would do huge damage to the UK's international relationships, including their trade agreement with the European Union, and also their relationship with the United States, which is of such importance. And there is a real premium at the moment on international unity as we try to face down Russian aggression against Ukraine. It sends a terrible message in terms of the UK's commitment to upholding its treaty obligations and wider international law. The only way forward is to work with the European Union in a constructive and pragmatic way to address and find solutions to the challenges that have been posed by the Northern Ireland Protocol. I mean, the protocol is there for very particular reasons. It reflects the choices made by both the UK government and the DUP around the nature of Brexit in terms of having a hard Brexit outside the customs union and single market. And with that, there comes inevitably some degree of line on a map, an interface drawn somewhere in these islands to police the interface between the single market of the European Union and the UK's economy. And wherever you draw that line, there will be a degree of friction and some threat to someone's identity. What we can do is mitigate that as far as we can, but we also have to be honest with people that reflects the choices made around Brexit. And there will be a limitation in terms of how far that can ultimately go, but certainly there's pressure out there. The key ingredient in all of... Sorry,
Stephen, I was going to say, where do you put the blame for the mess over the Northern Ireland Protocol? Because it is a mess, isn't it?
I put the blame entirely with both the UK government and the DUP. People went into Brexit not processing the implications of what it means, and in particular people charged towards a hard Brexit and turned down other alternatives that maybe would have softened the impact on a place like Northern Ireland. I mean Northern Ireland only really works through sharing and interdependence. We are part of the island of Ireland. We're also part of the UK. So businesses, people work on a north-south and east-west basis. The problem with Brexit is it comes along and tries to impose simplistic black and white solutions on a situation that requires a degree of complexity, a degree of nuance, some degree of shades of grey to make the situation work effectively. And all of that has been tossed up in the air. The protocol was the soft landing that provides Northern Ireland with a degree of protection. It allows Northern Ireland unfettered access to both the European and GB markets. So there's some degree of opportunity for Northern Ireland. It's not all about challenges. But some people just haven't come to terms with the implications of their own choices around Brexit. They haven't addressed the contradictions in terms of their position.
Stephen, there's also, though, a political reality in this, is that the DUP has said, you know, they won't join the executive unless changes are made to the protocol. So is this something the UK government just needs to do as a necessary step to get the DUP back into power sharing?
Well, the difficulty there is if they do that, if they unilaterally breach their agreements and leaving aside the wider international implications, what it does in terms of the Northern Ireland situation, it reopens the prospect of how the European Union is then going to place its own interface with the UK. And that raises the spectre of some form of checks on the island of Ireland. I mean, it's what we frame as the Brexit trilemma. There are three objectives that people, in terms of the UK government, want to have in particular. They want to have this hard Brexit. They want to avoid a border on the island of Ireland. They want to avoid checks down the Irish Sea. Well, you can only ever have two out of those three. You can't have all three at the same time. It's just the basic laws of Brexit. To avoid all three, we need to be back in the single market and customs union, or indeed back in the European Union. So those are the choices that are out there. So if they do this massive U-turn in that regard, then they potentially reopen many years of progress. And I don't think it'll add anything to the stability of the Assembly. I mean, people just have to recognise that the only way we can work this place is through sharing, power sharing, and through having some realistic soft landing for Brexit. There will always be a need for some form of special arrangements. And indeed, if you go for a very stark black and white solution, the danger is that you end up making Northern Ireland unworkable. and along working with Northern Ireland, that puts us into a much more polarised situation where it becomes a stark choice between Northern Ireland remaining part of the UK or people opting for United Ireland, and that could create a very difficult challenge for trying to keep it a shared and integrated Northern Ireland in together. So the stakes in this are really high.
I want to ask you about that election last week. Sinn Féin topping the poll, of course, made all the headlines. But actually, the Alliance had a pretty stunning election. You doubled your representation at the Assembly. Now, just tell us what sort of message were people sending trying to send by voting for the Alliance? So, what does it mean for the future of Northern Ireland?
Yeah, I mean it's a good result for us. Obviously, we're very happy, but it is somewhat bittersweet in the sense that we haven't got a functioning assembly and executive in place to do our work. The message behind that is probably threefold. It reflects, first of all, I mean, Alliance's growth over the past number of years. It reflects the growing diversity in Northern Ireland, where people have moved away from the traditional identities of unionism and nationalism, particularly amongst young people, and finally, and perhaps most current, it reflects people's desire to see the Assembly work. People on the doors during the election campaign were very clear with us. The priorities are to address the cost of living crisis, to reform our health system, to address our huge waiting lists. And all of that requires functioning institutions. So people last week voted for a pragmatic approach on the protocol, and they voted for delivery in terms of the political institutions.
Does it matter to you that Sinn Féin is the largest party now and would hold the First Minister position and the DUP would hold the Deputy First Minister position in a government? You've worked with both these parties before in power-sharing governments. Yeah. So does it actually change anything for you?
Well, I suppose in one sense, I mean our aspiration is that Alliance would be the largest party in Northern Ireland.
Well, you're third now, so you're moving up.
Moving up anyway. But we also reflect Northern Ireland is still a divided society. We have huge diversity in our politics. We have to have power sharing. That means we have to work in partnership with parties right across the political spectrum. And as you say, I mean, Sinn Féin have been part of the Northern Ireland executive right back to the Good Friday Agreement. And since 2007, they have been co-equals in the top office of First Minister and Deputy First Minister. All that has happened in the past few days is that Sinn Féin are now the largest party by two seats, and they will claim the title First Minister as opposed to Deputy First Minister. It is simply a difference of one word. There's no difference in terms of their power, authority, responsibilities, standing, duties. It's exactly the same, and just as it was prior to this election. So this is all based upon symbolism. In terms of substance, it doesn't really matter.
Stephen, are you worried that if no executive is formed and we're forced into another election in 6 months' time, that people who voted for Alliance are just going to return to their traditional community parties, back to those voting patterns which have held for decades?
Well, there's a lot of politics that will flow before we get to that point, and hopefully common sense does prevail over the coming days, and we get something back in place. But we don't fear an election if that's what it comes to. It's almost from our perspective, success breeds success. People see that we can make breakthroughs, we can win in places that historically we haven't won before, and that they maybe have more confidence now that they can vote for Alliance and make that real difference. So I think we would hope to consolidate even further if there was to be another election. But it's not something we are calling for. I mean, it's not something we think that Northern Ireland needs. I mean, there's a clear mandate from last week and people need to go on and do the job.
The big change here, of course, the Alliance Party moving up to 17 seats out of 90, it does pose a bit of a question over the structure of power sharing in Northern Ireland. Do we need structural change to that agreement now to take account of the fact that we're looking at three main political forces?
Yes, I mean, while we were always very strong supporters of the Good Friday Agreement, and we remain as such, we were, some say, concerned about some of the detailed mechanisms back in 1998, including designations. Now, they were almost put aside as, well, look, it's just an anomaly, don't worry about it. But today, they are clearly illegitimate. You can't stand over a situation where the votes of 17 people count for less in terms of some key votes. And it also sends a terrible signal to society that the first thing we do in the Assembly is to divide up the MLAs and the different camps. rather than promoting a vision where people work together. So that's something that those need to change. Now, we can do reform alongside a sitting assembly, but we're now approaching the 25th anniversary of the agreement, and nothing ever should stay the same forever. Things have to move in times.
Bloomberg Westminster. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
The Bloomberg Sustainable Business Summit returns to London on April 25th for a solutions-driven look at the sustainable business and finance landscape, looking at the latest trends in ESG regulations, supply chain innovation and transition finance. Speakers include leaders from CDP, Emirates Environment Group, Seedtrace, COA and more. Summit advisors include City Commercial Bank, Red Sea Global and Schneider Electric. Visit bloomberglive.com/SBS2024 to learn more.